Hi, I'm Danny Elfman.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Debbie Harry.
This is Chris Steyer Blondie.
This is Ronan Orzabal from Tears for Fears.
This is Billy Idol.
This is Alex Ebert, a.k.a. Edward Sharp, giving the story behind the song.
Hi, this is Peter Chotti, host of The Story Behind the Song. Each month I speak to some of music's biggest artists to get the inside stories behind their most lasting and iconic songs. Join me for new episodes on the third Monday of every month on The Story Behind the Song from the Consequence Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts.
From Pee-wee to Dumbo and everything in between, join us every Thursday in April for Filmography Tim Burton. Our five-part season will break down all 19 of Burton's feature-length films to date in detail. Follow Filmography on Spotify or wherever else you find your podcasts.
Consequence Podcast Network.
There is a podcast that is a world unto itself.
A podcast as boundless as space and as timeless as infinity.
It is the place between light and shadow.
Science and superstition.
It lies between the pit of humankind's
fears and the summit of our knowledge.
No, your ears don't deceive you.
You're not imagining things.
This is that podcast.
You've entered
the fifth dimension.
Greetings, travelers. I'm your host, Michael Rothman, editor-in-chief of Consequence of Sound and also a constant contributor to the Losers Club and Halloweenies. We're here on the second episode, or maybe the third, depending on if you want to include our pilot episode. It kind of gets kind of tricky when you do the numbers there, but we're going to be talking about the second episode and Jordan Peele's The Twilight Zone, and we're calling it The Comedian. And by we, I mean they're calling it. CBS is. Jordan Peele is. Before we go into The Comedian and start laughing and maybe even disappearing, let's introduce our fellow co-hosts, starting with...
This is Matt Mellis, the editorial director of Consequence of Sound. And can I just remark, I think it's amazing that we're all wearing the same outfits that we wore during the last episode.
Oh my God, we are. It's been so long, Matt.
And what are the odds?
I really did miss you for a second because... You know, a week is a very long time, but it's not a week because this is a two-episode premiere. So we've just been sitting in this room this whole entire time.
Oh, that explains a lot.
It does. Mm-hmm. To my right, please introduce yourself.
I'm Samantha. It's a good life Kuykendall. And I'm here because I'm just a gal who loves pop culture. And I can't wait to talk more about it with you guys. And thanks for, you know, giving a shit.
Well, we're here in the zone, but out there in the zone...
This is Eleanor. I'm in spooky Florida.
Would you call it spooky Florida? I'd call it weird Florida.
Yes. Jeepers Creepers was filmed there too, okay?
That is
spooky.
True.
Little lizards, right? They just...
Oh, yeah. I think it's telling that the first comedy episode of The X-Files was set in Florida. I think that sums it up.
That is true.
Humbug. It's just called Humbug, and it's amazing.
Yeah, well, Florida's a very kooky place, and I'm from there, originally from Miami, and I could think of many instances in that state where I definitely said, are we in the Twilight Zone? what about you, Eleanor? You're not actually from Florida. You're from Virginia?
Yeah, but Virginia's boring, so I moved where it's exciting. Just kidding. I love Virginia.
Would you say you've had a lot of zony moments down in Florida?
Definitely. I mean, when I first moved down here, I live in Orlando, and when I first moved down here, I didn't realize that there was a shuttle launching one day and looked up, and there it was going. You know, the smoke trail was zigging across the sky. It was very exciting. And there have been many launches since then that I've enjoyed thoroughly.
Yeah, I think the proximity to NASA and the whole team makes it already by a de facto place for the Twilight Zone.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of hope while looking ahead we get some space adventures because that was a big part of the original series. And insofar, we have not had those because this next episode doesn't take place in space. It takes place down here on Earth, the place that many of us have gone to, a comedy club. Now we've got the serious business out of the way. Let's start laughing with The Comedian. And in our first segment, we call Synopsis.
Ooh.
Ooh, what a creative name. Matt, read us your own penned synopsis, and you can go Peele or Serling or Melis.
Or Seinfeld.
Do Seinfeld.
No, I can't do Seinfeld.
You can't do Seinfeld? No.
I have done a couple this past year. I did my first ever comedy sets.
Did actually. You really?
I did two stand-up.
Oh, we're going to be talking about that in this episode.
Oh, boy.
Because once again, I said it's The Comedian. So what is The Comedian about, Matt?
You know, Michael, Samir Wasan, he's a struggling comedian who is given the power to turn his personal life into comic material that's guaranteed to bring him fame and fortune. Unfortunately, though, when he opens his life up, the things and people he loves start vanishing. You have to ask, just how far is Samir willing to go to keep the laughs a-coming?
Well, Samir is just one of many stars and souls in this episode.
You walk into this room at your own risk, because it leads to the future. Not a future that will be, but one that might be. This is not a new world. It is simply an extension of what began in the old one.
Now, in this section, we like to talk about the characters and the casting. In this case, we'll start with the man of the hour, Samir. So what do we think about Samir? What is his predicament that he's in right now? He's not very funny, right?
No, he sucks. He's a bad comedian.
I thought that this recurring joke that he keeps leaning on...
over and over again.
I mean, look, I know you have... even when he has his power, I'm like, try something different, dude. Like...
He
Come
still
on.
Keeps going for it.
I know. I mean, at some point, you just got to be like, get off the stage, write something new. That was actually one of the more confounding things in this episode. This is a series that is so entrenched in the comic realm in real life, just because Peele has so many connections to it, that you think they would write maybe one more other joke that he would try something, but he just keeps going for it. I thought that maybe added some pathos to him, but yeah. It also kind of made me irritated. But what do you think?
Well, you do notice... they don't write many jokes for this whole. There's not much comedy here.
No, there isn't.
And we'll get more into how that happens, but it is actually it's so hard to do well, and we've seen it on the Marvelous Mrs.
Marvelous Maisel,
where they have to actually write comedy routines, mm-hmm. and that's
even
tricky.
Crashing HBO like they that's oh, yeah. like a lot about what it's like to kind of try to make a name for yourself in mm-hmm. the comedy scene,
and also in Seinfeld. Remember that mm-hmm. show?
You know, I think I've heard of it.
Oh yeah, it's a good one.
Here's the thing. So there's people who they don't think there should be any regulations on guns. And yet they say the Second Amendment.
Oh, no, don't do this.
And yet when we read the Second Amendment, it says the first three words are a well-regulated militia.
My head is
That's like
11.1%.
I mean, imagine if your flight only got 11.1% to where
it
was going.
No, I don't want this joke. I don't want this joke.
See, it didn't work for me either. Folks, that's the joke we're talking about.
I want you to start talking about me because I would like to disappear from this moment. I do think it's interesting that joke's the one that's bombing because it is sort of the type of humor that's super popular right now, is the political stuff and less so of the personal and family stuff that he goes back to. But maybe that's just because it doesn't work in stand up. But he cares about something and that's really nice,
Yeah. He does try. I mean, I will say I love the casting here because to make this work, you can't have someone. I mean, some people just get up there and look funny. You want to start laughing with them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like you want to join in with them. Kumail Nanjiani's not one of those guys, and he plays it perfectly at the beginning as this insecure, like almost too sweet for the business guy, right? But then later on, we find out he can, kick it up a notch, and he does that well too. So, I mean, this guy was able to pull it out as both the sweetheart, at the beginning, the sweetie, and then the asshole later on.
I'm a huge fan of Kumail Nanjiani. I think that he's just he's got a real multifaceted approach to his delivery and his performances. I thought The Big Sick was one of the best films of 2017. And I actually in that film you get to see some of his more, dramatic performances. And previously in Silicon Valley, you don't really get to see that as much because it's just more just the comic timing. And I thought that it really did lead his performance here. And I thought that out of the two episodes that we've seen so far, I thought actually his performance is the strongest. It's a very nuanced performance because he definitely does care about his family. But this is, a downward spiral in the classic sense in that you just see him as more things chip away. And he does kind of go into this hell that the Twilight Zone definitely takes him down. But why does he go into hell? Because we haven't really explained that yet. So who does he meet? at the comedy club that opens these doors. Matt, tell us.
He meets, and brace yourselves, folks, none other than the J.C. Wheeler.
J.C. Wheeler?
In the fleshy flesh.
Oh, my God. I've actually heard his sets are supposed to be amazing and out of this world, out of the zone.
Yeah, he was on top, but then, poof, he vanished.
Oof. And he's played by another than
Tracy Morgan. Morgan, who at one point was on top and then kind of poof, he vanished.
Yeah, right? You know, Tracy Morgan has had a huge comeback after he
30 said, Rock, yeah. Well, after SNL.
Well, he also had some...
He got in a car accident.
Yeah, he had a car accident.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
For his bounce back recently has been incredible because he's been...
It's a show on TBS now.
Yeah, like, no, but this is a great performance from him. And he plays a perfect Twilight Zone archetype.
And he has maybe the greatest Grinch smile I've ever seen, which I've seen the very last scene.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, he's definitely like an all-knowing character, too. He knows what he's going to do to Samir in that scene. Like, he knows what's going to happen. And you almost get the sense that this has, like, happened to him already. And he's used all his material, and now he's a has-been comic because he talked about all the people in his life that he could have talked about.
Well, yeah, he's all-knowing but not all-telling.
Yes, very exactly. True.
But yeah, I don't know if he's the warning, like the harbinger saying, I told all these jokes and look where it got me, or if he is actually the person you make the pact with, because, you know, they have that toasting moment where the magic is passed on, but, you know, is Samir supposed to pass it on and he just doesn't? Or,
well, he's kind of the genie in a bottle almost, you know.
Or is he like the Jacob Marley? That's the question, right? Is he there to warn these people in a way this could happen? Or is he there to, like Eleanor says, like, be the devil or whatever, making the pact?
I think he's the devil slash genie. I mean, I think goes back to so many episodes of The Twilight Zone. You just have this figure that comes in. He's able to solve all your problems, but it's going to have, you know...
It has a price.
It's a be careful what you wish for.
Thing. Yeah, it's more than you bargain for. The bargain that's
more than you bargain for. That's always what it is. Because they give you what you want, but it's what you use it for. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean... It's almost like the angel and the devil on your shoulder kind of thing, where it's like he wants you to make the right decision, but that's in your hands.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is in his hands when he after he speaks to JC? What is Samir able to do?
He gets rid of his dog.
Well, the power that he is. We got to go back a little bit. When Samir goes on stage and he starts telling jokes, whoever he's willing to make a joke about disappears. As if they're just erased from existence.
Like,
because what JC told him was, you know, if you want to make people laugh, get off the Second Amendment shit that ain't funny. You got to talk about, you got to open up to your real life, your experiences.
Talk about what you know.
Right. Talk about, you know, give them a piece of yourself. Mm-hmm. But he says then, of course, once you do, it's gone.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what we're...
There are a lot of themes to glean from this one, especially in a modern age.
So
it's on the table, what's off limits when you're a public figure.
Yeah, exactly. and I think that's in a day and age in which we demand so much of our entertainers, I think that there's some great commentary there. Mm-hmm. But what is at stake? Who are the characters that are victims of this this curse? Or is it a power? I think it's more of a curse, but...
I think it depends on how you use it. Mm-hmm. What, I mean, as Uncle Ben once said, with great power comes great responsibility.
Oh, yes. But Peter Parker didn't wander around, you know, zapping people out of existence.
It's from Spider-Man.
From Spider-Man. You know?
Uncle Ben? Yeah.
Yeah, Sam Raimi.
I've never heard of that before.
You never heard
with great power comes great responsibility?
I'm just fucking.
Okay, I was like, what the fuck?
It's classic literature in this modern age.
Yes.
We love comic
books.
That's
Shakespeare.
Yeah, seriously.
Okay, Bill Maher.
Yeah, right? Oh, God. So Samir gets this power, and... He starts noticing that whatever he's talking about is getting laughs, first off, which he hasn't had, and he's loving this. But what is the first thing that he loses?
His dog.
His dog. Oh, my God.
Cat. Or cat. Caterpillar.
Yeah.
But cat for short.
Yeah, which I thought was pretty funny.
Oh, I thought it was great.
I thought the name of his dog was funnier than the actual joke that he was telling.
Oh,
originally.
God, I would have to concur.
I'm just going to say, at any of the nights I've gone to, and I've limited to two, he would have bombed with his dog. You all look like dogs taking a shit. My dog pissed on my pizza material.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have flown.
No, and that's one of the minor, you know, quibbles I have with this episode is that none of the jokes that he's actually telling are even jokes.
JC promises you'll get laughs.
Yeah.
You'll get what you want. He won't say you'll be funny.
That's part of the power. I don't think you actually have to tell a joke after that. You just have to expose something personal, something real.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes you just screams names, right?
And
yeah.
Exactly. Which in turn affects his girlfriend, Amara Karan's character. I think that's how you pronounce her last name.
Amara Karan? Yeah.
Karan? Yeah.
Rena?
who's also in The Night Of. She's also in one of my favorite Doctor Who episodes, The God Complex, which is also another spooky episode. But I thought she was great in this, too. Like, she's one of my favorite characters in the episode.
Yeah. Whereas we kind of know where this is going to head.
Sure.
You know, I kind of figured that, spoiler alert, he was going to have to sacrifice himself to end all this madness. The journey to get there is pretty interesting. And this goes in some crazy zigs and zags.
Yeah. Like, if not himself, he was going to at least have to get to that point where someone he really cared about, he might have to decide, are the laughs worth vanishing them?
Yeah.
You know? And then obviously I think it went even more interesting with where it did go.
Yeah, because I mean, because this show, and this is something we didn't really get to address in the first episode, but you know, these are longer episodes. This is kind of like in the latter era of the original run of The Twilight Zone, in which these aren't just 30-minute episodes. These are like 40, 50-minute episodes. And I think what's great about that is that you're actually able to kind of breathe in this world a little bit more. You know, you're actually able to kind of see some of the more consequences and kind of, you know, add some sort of layers to character. And, you know, because by the end, when he's actually zapping away characters that we do know, it's so much more affecting.
And, well, I mean, this would have been a very different episode if it was the old, hey, we have 22 minutes and we have commercials. Oh, yeah. Because one of the things that threw me off was, okay, he just disappeared Caterpillar, right? We've lost the dog. Doesn't know what's going on yet. Then he loses his
nephew.
Girlfriend's nephew, right?
Yeah.
And he still doesn't, you know, I mean, we've just lost a 10-year-old boy here.
Yeah.
And he still isn't for sure certain, oh, I did that. Then he figures out, you know what I mean? So We've lost a 10-year-old boy, and we haven't even made like a moral ethical decision yet. Mm. That's typically where this episode would end up, where the boy or his girlfriend was at stake. You know, that'd be the very last thing he would do.
Yeah,
we're
no,
there
10 right.
minutes into a 50-minute episode, and like, we've lost the cat, we've lost the boy. Who's dog
next?
Gets the cat. Who the hell would let anyone near this guy? You know, you shouldn't be babysitting.
I do think in like a shorter episode, I don't think we would have had like Cape Crusader moment. Mm.
Oh, yeah.
Like, well, because then he gets rid of the comedian that's a dick to him who caused the drunk driving accident that killed two people at the bus stop.
Which definitely pivots this into him being this sort of like vigilante.
Yeah, but again, sure, he saves the lives of two people, but he also takes advantage of the situation and gets rid of his competition.
Yeah, he's kind of a schmuck.
He's an asshole.
Exactly. I mean, he's in a situation here where he really breaks down. He goes, oh my God, I know what happened to the dog, right? I know what happened to your nephew. He's breaking down there. He thinks he's crazy or that he actually did this. He isn't sure. And then starts rationalizing a little bit. Well, I didn't quite kill him. He never existed. And okay, maybe I'm not going to go after family members, but I can go after people I look up on Facebook who I used to know that I don't like.
Yeah.
You know, so
exactly.
I mean, in no way is this moral behavior, but he starts drawing new lines because, again, he's getting the laughs that he never got. He went up there 100 times, never got one laugh or got, you know, stale chuckles. All of a sudden, they love him, you know. So what is he willing to do? He's willing to, you know, go throw some of those jerks from high school. What would you do? That's the what would you do part, right?
Yeah.
Would you, for success, would you do that to your old, those people you hated back in the day? You
know, I'll answer that in a little bit when we get down that road. But
he becomes a monster in a way.
Yeah, oh, he is a total monster. But Eleanor, what do you make of this?
Yeah, no, he justifies it way too quickly for himself. And I wonder, this may not be the time in the podcast for this, but I wonder at which point he lost each of us, you know? You're on his side for a while because you're like, And I do think if he had understood what was happening and disappeared the dog and recognized that, it would have been really serious.
Yeah.
Because dogs are important.
I can vouch for that.
Yeah, dogs are very important, especially if it was a corgi.
Yeah, I think it comes down again to, if this was an old episode, he would have figured out what was going on, probably with the dog.
Yeah.
And then he would have had to make a moral decision. And he doesn't, I guess the decision he makes is, I can get over Devin and keep this going as long as I give up something for my life that's not too close. You know, it's not someone I directly care about. But what he ends up finding out by doing that is eventually it's going to bite you on the ass, as he finds out when he gets rid of his girlfriend's mentor.
Yeah.
And I say mentor meaning a guy that's, what, 15 years older than her, has a sweater, a beard, and
he's the Jan.
You know, and is there eating dinner with her when you show up after your comic set. That's the type of mentor we are talking about. And of course, he finds out that ends up affecting her and ends up affecting him. So it does keep snowballing on him. But I mean, that first time it's like Elor said, like he got really comfortable too quickly with getting rid of people.
Would you say his rampage is spawned from when he sees his girlfriend's predicament? Because he just feels like all hope is lost.
Oh, definitely. But I think he was on it before. I think he was feeling the high of the power and feeling totally justified and like he was doing a good thing. In the beginning, things are really simple. Like the two things he cares about are his girlfriend, Reyna, and hypocrisies in gun control law, you know?
Yes. I thought the cruelest thing that happened is when he kind of goes after this competition.
That is where he lost me.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right?
Let's bring this into focus here. So you were okay with him getting rid of like hundreds of people from high school who were judged
to
him.
Because
let's be honest, you got picked on a lot. So
yeah, that says a lot about me. But you know, you have not only do you have a character who literally just like point blank admits that she's wrong about him and that he's funny. Yeah. I mean, she totally, you know, confesses to him and opens up to him. And then he still turns around and just boom.
Nixes her. That is the thing. Like, I think he's misguided up until that point. You know, he's like fooling himself. But then when he hits that point, he knows exactly what he's doing. And, you know, I think that's where we're supposed to turn on him.
Yeah, well said. I think that's perfectly put. And it really is that question. I think Jordan Peele puts like, what is more important to you? What are you willing to do?
Well, he even says in the episode that he, like, there's a whole dialogue he has where he talks about how he wants people to talk about him.
Yeah.
And he wants his name on people's lips, basically. And that's what matters to him, is that he's talked about and he's relevant. And we're in a day and age right now that's all anyone wants right now, is we just want to show the best aspects of ourselves. We want everyone to see how wonderful our lives are all the time. And I think that that's like a major downfall of his, is that he is willing to give up everything that matters to him so that people are talking about him.
Mm-hmm. And he comes to the conclusion too, after things have backfired on him for the real first time, he comes to the conclusion that, you know, maybe you have to give up something to get something. Which, you know, again, is, I think, him totally fooling himself here, you know?
I just think he's another soulless victim of the Twilight Zone. Am I putting a button on that? I think that's fair to say. I think he loses his soul by the end of the whole thing.
No, I definitely, I mean, I even wrote in my notes that it's this kind of, I sold my soul to the devil to obtain what I wanted. You know, it's that classic trope of, what are you willing to give up to get what you want? And it's not always a great ending there.
No.
Whenever you get into these types of stories where you finally get everything you ever wanted, right? Or you have the power to get everything you ever wanted. What it really does is it reveals who you really are.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So like people always say, like, you know, if you get $10 million, you don't become a better person. You just become more of the person you already are. You know, you have the ability to go do even more of what you already do or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think it's a case where he finds things out about himself, and I think his girlfriend, sort of in one of the standoffs at the end, you know, sort of the showdowns scenes, she, you know, she really makes him realize. I mean, he comes to the conclusion, I'm not quite the guy I thought I was, or at least there's other sides to me that I didn't know were there or that could come out and play at times. And then I think that kind of leads to that sort of ending.
We talked about a lot of similarities and familiarities about this episode, and I think, like Nightmare at 30,000 Feet, there are a lot of echoes to the past, especially in Twilight Zone lore. And I think we should talk about that in our next section, Light and Shadow.
We know that a dream can be real, but whoever thought that reality could be a dream? Think about it, and then ask yourself, do you live here, in this country, in this world, or do you live instead in the Twilight Zone?
All right. In this section, we like to talk about the parallels to old episodes and beyond, especially in, you know, other artifacts in pop culture. And I think there are a lot of allusions you can tie to past episodes here.
Definitely. I think the man in the bottle from season 2 of the episode where it's like an elderly couple who owns an antique shop.
Oh, absolutely.
And they rub a vase, I believe it is, and a genie pops out.
Yep.
And he grants them 3 wishes. And one of the wishes he makes is to have $1 million, or it's something like, I'm pretty sure it's $1 million. And he just starts handing it out to the townsfolk. Mm-hmm. And then someone comes in, he's like a tax guy who collects the money. And he's like, you owe us this amount of money. So it's like essentially all the money that he asked for from the genie. And so I felt a lot of parallels to that, and I think The Man in the Bottle is a perfect example as to the loophole wish trope, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think even without the genie, there's always that notion in the Twilight Zone that, like, whatever you're wanting or whatever you desire, you're never really going to actually attain. You know, even like, you know, like Time Enough at Last, you know, one of the most classic episodes of the Twilight Zone, this is this guy who finally has all this time to read and his glasses break. So there's always just some twist that's going to fuck you over in the Twilight Zone. For me, like, I actually thought there are a few episodes that this certainly reminded me of. For instance, like one of the first season episodes, What You Need, in which you have this thug that's like trying to exploit some peddler who can see into the future and discern just like what a person will need in an emergency. And like that sort of notion of whoever's coming in that can help you in the Twilight Zone, usually it's not as if he has like mm-hmm. ill intentions, but he's there to prove some sort of, you know, morality to for mm-hmm. the actual protagonist that's at hand. And just even the idea of people disappearing reminds me of like Anthony Fremont and It's a Good Life. Just the way that they,
You mean me?
Yeah, you, exactly. But I mean, obviously they don't go to some sort of proverbial cornfield. Who knows? I don't know where these people go. They just kind of get zooped out of existence. But that way that he was so able to just kind of write down names and get angry at them certainly reminded me of that.
Yeah, definitely this is a pact with the devil, you know, make a bad deal, monkey paw situation. But it also got me thinking about the episodes that are about performers, like The Trouble with Templeton and The 16-Inch Shrine, both of which talk about performers who kind of get stuck in the performance. And so with Trouble with Templeton, there's a line in the closing narration about how he got himself a round trip ticket to the Twilight Zone. And I was thinking that sometimes you get out.
Yeah.
Sometimes you Jordan Peele's get out, but sometimes sometimes you get stuck. And I think that he was Samir is one of the ones who gets stuck, just like the main character in the 16mm shrine.
There's even a little bit of The Big Tall Wish, which is one of my favorite episodes too, in that dealing of magic. And in that one, that's more about like second chances and how this guy's own sort of like hubris couldn't actually allow him to let that magic exist. And so all that goes away. And that one ends actually not so tragic as this. Even beyond the Twilight Zone, that, Matt, you actually brought up a good point. It was like the ending straight up from The Shining. Like,
yeah,
you know,
I mean, there's an homage to The Shining.
Well, at least Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. But
yeah, Stanley Kubrick's yeah, where we see him. Just like you saw Jack Nicholson in the photo, they'd always been at the Overlook. You see Samir in that audience. At the beginning, it's kind of actually a cool effect. At the beginning, they show painted faces on a wall, and you think maybe they're the audience, but it's actually just, you know, again, it's a painting on the wall. You look at the actual tables. They're there to see Samir's act, and they're mostly empty. And then at the end, he becomes one of those faces in the crowd on the wall. Again, just I think Jordan Peele saying, hey, you know, there's been a lot of great stuff that's inspired us. Inspired me as a storyteller over the years. So I think it was just a wink or a nod, you know, tip of the cap to someone.
And he is a huge fan of that, because in the Key and Peele episode, in one of the Continental skits, well, in a lot of the Continental skits in Key and Peele, there are references to, one of them references the Twilight Zone with Nightmare at 30,000 Feet. And then
The hotel one references The Shining. Yeah. I'll have what I'm having.
Yeah. And as we could, God, I love that skit. and as you could tell from Jordan Peele's wardrobe recently, he clearly loves The Shining, as he dressed up pretty much as like Jack Torrance. But did anyone notice in the background, in the actual dressing room, you could see a ventriloquist that looks strangely like the dummy that's in the episode with Cliff Robertson called The Dummy? It was the season 3 episode. It's right there in the corner. I definitely tried to pause and zoom in, but I'm pretty sure that's supposed to be
it
like
looked
a little,
just like him. Yeah. When we were watching it, you pointed him out to me. Yeah, I agree.
I want to say that's like a nice little token reference for sure. And I'm wondering if that's going to be the case for a lot of episodes, because clearly we had the, you know, the doll that was floating on the ocean in the first episode. You have the ventriloquist dummy. I'm wondering if this is trying to like kind of send out the message that this is still in the same universe as the first series.
I think Easter eggs will be prominent. And yeah. I think that that's smart of him, because it's It's almost like what Castle Rock did for Stephen King in its best times.
Yeah.
Was, you know, give little nods to the fans that necessarily don't mean anything to the plot. But if you are a fan of the series and it means something to you and you're well versed in it, you notice it.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't mean that you have to have watched every episode to understand what's happening.
Yeah.
But you at least kind of see that little nod. And I think that's how, like, those are the best types of Easter eggs, when it doesn't have to do, it's not being shoved down your throat, you know?
We kind of praise the creator, Jordan Peele, every episode. But I mean, it shows his love of these properties. It shows how much care he puts in an episode. To put, you know, to put something into an episode that maybe only a handful of people would pick up on, or, you know, maybe only a handful of people would be able to see, and only if they zoomed in. But he just liked the idea that it was there, you know? Because I remember I was reading your review, and there was a line where he said, there's no pressure. The reward is I get to go to work and I get to work on this stuff, and it's fun. And I really think he's right now at this point in his career, and especially with the Twilight Zone, he's a kid in a candy store. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure he might have been that way maybe on Key and Peele, where it's just like, I get to go out, I get to create this stuff. Here's all the stuff I love. And he's, you know, he's going to throw it in there. And again, you want someone who's that enthusiastic. You want someone who loves the material as much as you do, but of course also has the talent and the ability to put it out there, put it together. You know, I shouldn't be making the show, but I love that he loves this stuff as much as I do.
And I would much rather have these little subtle homages than doing like full on remakes of episodes or any other sort of revisitations. Because like, I don't actually feel we need to redo episodes at all. I mean, I'm actually, one of the things I do love about this episode is the fact that while yes, there are some sort of similar themes and motifs of past episodes that we've seen on the Twilight Zone for sure, just especially as Eleanor mentioned with like the monkey's paw thing. Eleanor, did you catch any more parallels, or were you good there?
I didn't, but I do think that they're both a wink, like, hey, I'm with you. I'm, you know, a fan. I see it. But also a differentiation. So they're saying it's cool. We're on the same page, but also this is different from the old episodes. This is new.
We're going to take a break for a second, and we're going to send you a nice message. Because before we travel onward into deeper dimensional drifts, it serves us well to let you know that our continued existence rests entirely in your hands. If you find The Fifth Dimension to be a welcome escape to your favorite anthology of the unknown, please consider rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts or Podchaser. Apple Podcasts is the largest podcasting platform there is, so taking the time to share your thoughts there means a lot. On that note, Podchaser is an incredible resource for podcast discovery, including host profiles, so you can follow our exploits across other series, and the ability to rate and review specific episodes, create lists, and more. Do us the tremendous favor of leaving a review, and we just might read it here on the show. We should also tell you that if you're a fan of thrills, chills, and paranormal experiences, you should check out some of our other series here on the Consequence Podcast Network. The Losers Club, a Stephen King podcast, or Halloweenies, where we dissect horror franchises one film at a time, beginning with Halloween and now the Nightmare on Elm Street series. If you haven't yet, be sure to add The Fifth Dimension to Twilight Zone podcast to your preferred podcast app so you'll never miss an episode. And keep the discussion going with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by searching for Fifth Dimension Podcast. Now that we've finished that lovely little message, we're going to move on to science and superstition.
Obscure a metaphysical explanation to cover a phenomenon. Reasons dredged out of the shadows to explain away that which cannot be explained. Call it parallel planes or just insanity. Whatever it is, you find it in the Twilight Zone.
All right, in this section, we discuss the fundamentals and the mechanics of the zone, debate whether this episode is science fiction or fantasy, and specifically what made us sweat, what gave us the heebie-jeebies, the creeps. So I want to start with you, Sammy.
I definitely think it's fantasy.
Totally.
Obviously. I mean, we're dealing with a genie or like djinn type with Tracy Morgan's character, which is a character we've seen. I don't know if any of you guys have watched Stars, American Gods. There's like a whole episode to a djinn. Also, this is gonna like make me seem very lame, but Supernatural has done a bunch of djinn episodes as well.
Oh, lame.
I know. I'm well aware.
Just CW girl over here.
I am. Yeah. And I will not lie about it, okay?
Those boys are so cute.
I've watched every episode of that stupid show. Anyways, what I'm saying is the djinn is a fantasy trope. It always will be. It has really nothing to do with science fiction. It's the story that we've seen over and over again. you know, of course, the be careful what you wish for thing. So I don't see any sci-fi in this episode at all. I think it's just kind of fantasy grounded in reality and what they do with what they're given.
And that's kind of what makes me excited about this series. More recently, the only thing we've really had that's been close to the Twilight Zone is mostly like Black Mirror. And Black Mirror is so relegated specifically to science fiction because it's all about technology and what, you know, all the ills that come from it. So when you see something like this, it does remind you of just how fantastical this show can really be and just how many different genres you can really, you know, go for. And I don't know, for me, that was just, it's reinvigorating, and it just reminded me of just how much I miss this show.
Unlike Nightmare at 30,000 Feet, it didn't feel like this was entirely the product of a human mind. Like, that was not a possibility. Like, something was actually triggering some kind of magic. So I would put it, obviously, it's got some fantasy roots, but I would put it a little bit more on the sci-fi side of the continuum, because you're dealing with infinite universes and time travel and not directly, but those types of concepts, which are more towards the sci-fi area. You know, if there's a universe where your girlfriend's mentor doesn't exist, or a universe where that guy from high school doesn't exist, it kind of changes everything, and you're looking at a whole new universe.
Well, I guess that kind of goes into more of like the fundamentals and the mechanics of this particular zone. Like, are we to assume that like when he makes that joke and they laugh, he himself is maybe shifting to different universes, per se?
Oh, maybe.
You know? Like, maybe he's standing up there and he's and the stage is almost like this vessel for him to kind of go to wherever, you know, alternate reality that he's dictating at that moment. I'm just getting into the nitty-gritty of things, but
so you think it's potential his set actually takes place on a stage in another dimension. Or in the Twilight Zone.
Yeah,
because the Twilight Zone sort of in that moment.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, nobody remembers who he's talking about. You know, he makes that these jokes. Everyone's making laughing about it, but nobody remembers who he's talking about. Even his, you know, his girlfriend, when he mentions, you know, her mentor.
Yeah. And they don't remember the jokes. They just laughed at, nor do they remember maybe someone they just met.
Yeah. So it makes me wonder if it's actually Samir going to different planes of existence, if we're going to be going by like that sci-fi nature, which I kind of like it in a way too, because there's two different ways you could look at it. You could see if there is this idea that someone's totally being wiped away, that's fantastical for sure.
And unlike Nightmare at 30,000 Feet, and they kind of answered this, but I do wonder, does he get to wherever he's going and everybody else is there? Everybody else who's been disappeared is there going, hey, what the heck, man? You know?
Yeah.
But I'm so glad they didn't answer that. I'm so glad they left it slightly ambiguous, but also stuck him in the
Me too. Picture. Me too. And especially since, you know, you see at the end that he is a part of that sort of mural.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone he vanished is back and good to go.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of...
Because if he didn't exist, does that mean that they come back into existence?
Yeah, I don't think that they never really answer that, per se.
He's there if you know to look, but if you don't know to look, you would never notice him.
Which is almost like a commentary on just like, you know, past comics and, you know, entertainers in general. What made us sweat? What were some moments here that just really got under your skin?
I don't know that this episode really got under my skin. Like, no? I wasn't really stressed out for anyone. I mean, there was a sense of danger for sure, but like, it's not like they died, like the people that he wished away. They just didn't exist. And from someone who constantly wishes they didn't exist at times, it's this freeing feeling of like how nice it would be to like not have to worry about stuff. And it's not like you killed this person or people remember you or anything. You're not there anymore. Mm-hmm. And
just
people
let me
go
say,
on.
I am good worrying about stuff. Don't do me any favors and wish me away, please. I'll deal with my daily stresses.
Well, Matt Mellis. No, I'm just joking.
Whoa.
Oh, my God.
What made me sweat?
Yeah, what got under your skin?
Eleanor, did you want to go before me?
Yeah, go for it, Eleanor.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, who's this Matt Mellis you're talking about? I've never heard
what?
Of
what? Oh,
person.
I don't.
He doesn't exist.
Oh, my God, he don't exist.
Yeah.
Okay, very funny, you know, but if you do this for about 30 more seconds and you're all in on it, I'm totally going to start believing it. So.
Do you hear a buzzing?
Let's cut this out now. That was good, though. Yeah. That was good.
I just wanted him to make good decisions, and I knew he wasn't going to, because otherwise, you know, it wouldn't be television, but, you know, I was... When he started thinking he could change the world for the better. I was going, no, buddy, come on. You know, yeah, like you do.
The self-righteousness got to you for sure.
Was he making the world better, or was he just like, these are people are disposable? That's what I thought.
He was making the world better for himself,
I guess. But then he's also getting rid of people that were like either drunk drivers or abusers and whatnot.
Yeah, but he wouldn't have gotten rid of that character if he wasn't competition to himself.
Yeah, I guess so.
I think whenever you step over that line and you are, you know, to quote George Bush, who we all miss actually right now, when you make yourself the decider, you know, I mean, that's, you've crossed the line when you get to decide who vanishes. But for me, what made me sweat, there was a couple things that I really liked. I thought Rena, and that was, again, Amara Karen. She, again, was that one person who could sort of make him see himself for what he had become. And I thought she was brilliant in it. And I really, really loved the backfire. Again, mm-hmm. when he's punishing the past or being a vigilante or just doing it because these people are disposable and he can get, you know, ahead by it. I love when it backfires and, you know, he realizes, oh my God, you'd become a lawyer without your mentor. And oh my God, we didn't get to go to France. So as much as you've started disliking this guy and seeing what he's capable of, I do think in that moment that he seriously said, oh my God, I really screwed things up. But then again, he gets over it fairly quickly until the end. So I don't know. I mean, but that idea that, oh my God, this came back to bite me like that, and this affected the one person out there I really love, you know, I mean, and changed her and changed her life forever. That gave me sweats. And then the other thing was that I thought was, and again, I love the visuals, but I like the fact that whether you were in a diner, whether you were in his apartment, a comedy club. I love how it was all lit the same.
Yeah.
The same lighting. And like, if you blacked out everything, you would have like a star grid of just these, you know, lights here and there. And like the light, it reminded me of like, you ever see Dark City?
Yeah.
And they go like, you know, there were a couple day scenes, but they go, do you ever remember when it wasn't dark?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just, because it wouldn't be like that in real life. It was just the way I felt like. When I saw that lighting, I was in the Twilight Zone.
I actually thought this is the best directed of the two. Mm-hmm. I thought that the close shots and just the set design mm-hmm. reminded me so much of the old series. And I actually was wondering what it would look like if you actually set it in black and white. And I think it wouldn't look mm-hmm. too dissimilar from what you saw.
The close-ups on the faces mm-hmm. laughing.
Yeah.
I think it would have been fine in black and white. And I think like the mm-hmm. whole time we were watching it, because we watched them in reverse. Watched the comedian first. The mm-hmm. whole time Mike and I were watching it, we were waiting for Jordan Peele to make his appearance. And then when he finally stepped out into their apartment and started mm-hmm. talking, it fit so perfectly. He did everything so right. And I grabbed Mike's arm and I was like, this is it. Like, this is what we wanted. Yeah. And it lived up to what I thought was not going to be very good. So I think his narration and everything about this episode flowed very well.
I think the biggest difference was the time, like you said, because it was long enough that you could figure out that he's got to take himself out, and you figure that out about halfway through. But then the way it was such a slow intro, you know, like you had time to set a full scene like you would in a movie or a show.
Yeah.
It was a huge difference, and it was beautiful.
For me, I might have already mentioned, you know, the situation with competing comic. Matt, did you have the name for her?
It was Dee Dee Scott, who was interesting because they went with, I believe, you know, a black lesbian comedian who was very, you know, upfront.
Just vicious towards him.
Vicious towards him, but I mean, her humor, you know, she wasn't holding back, you know, at all, you know, with that style of comedy for sure.
And that's the stuff that he does that gets him in trouble, which is kind of funny. But I thought, with her arc was very interesting because obviously they come from a sense of place where they understand each other, mm-hmm. but she gives him so much shit until she doesn't. And then that turns out to be almost her downfall also. I mean, it's just, I really thought her character was interesting. And I thought that, to Eleanor's point about the time, that really played into my own anxieties towards her, because I actually ended up caring for her, which was mm-hmm. something that doesn't really get to, you don't really get to have that in a 30-minute show, because you don't get to actually spend time with that person. So for me, I thought that was incredibly effective. Right.
You got the sense that there was a day in and day out grind for them. Mm-hmm. And she gave him shit because she was she was on top of the mountain there for a while. But I mean, there was a mutual respect because she knows, because you know, at some point she was him up there.
Yeah.
Maybe not talking about the Second Amendment, but you know, maybe the Third Amendment, whatever. I don't even know what that is.
Well, it's a very mad. Yeah.
But you know, I mean, it's she had been there. So there's a mutual respect. And I love when Tracy Morgan's urging him on, just do what you got to do, make it happen, which makes us, again, I think, wonder what was Tracy Morgan's real intentions here when he's like, you need to go that final mile, you know? But I love that when he says, I don't want to go on tonight, it's not worth it to me. She goes, oh, no, you're going on because I earned this.
Yeah.
You know, I paid my dues. I'm going to get this the right way. Like, you're not going to lay down for me, too. And I loved her for that. I thought she was an awesome character.
Yeah, she's probably my favorite character of this episode, for sure. And I just think that's why it really hit hard when, like, he actually turned on her. So let's go on to the lesson.
The tools of conquest do not necessarily come with bombs and explosions and fallout. There are weapons that are simply thoughts, attitudes, prejudices, to be found only in the minds of men. For the record, prejudices can kill.
What this provoked for me, you know, you have that question of, is he justified in offing the bad people? And one thing that I really like about certain Twilight Zone episodes from the old series is that they do have a lot of forgiveness and empathy and, you know, not always forgiveness, but definitely empathy. So something like Judgment Night, you're going to see, you know, somebody who's getting his comeuppance, you know, the German boat commander. I don't remember what he's called.
Right.
Who bombs the civilian ship or torpedoes the civilian ship and then has to relive that over and over again as though he were a passenger on the civilian ship. You know, you're not feeling sympathy for him, except that you kind of do, you feel for him because he's having to live with his sins. And then there are other episodes, like Dust was one that came to mind, because it's specifically about essentially a drunk driver. It's just set in the Old West. So this guy runs over a kid and kills a kid. And then you spend the entire episode realizing that he's worthy of your forgiveness, or that, you know, wanting blood for the blood isn't going to make things better. That was not a component of the approach to the comedian, who the drunk driver comedian, you know, we aren't really supposed to feel any sympathy for him. And that made me really uncomfortable.
Oh. Really?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not defending drunk driving, obviously.
We should all be uncomfortable with that. I agree.
Yeah, that you can't be the person who makes, you know, that's not one person's decision to decide if someone's right or wrong.
It's like a God complex. You can't be the person to make the decision whether someone lives or dies. It's not a human thing. We can't have that.
And we all do bad things.
It's like in 12 Angry Men, where the one juror goes to the other, why is it so important for you to flip the switch, you know, on the kid? You know, I mean, we should be uncomfortable with being, you know,
the decider.
The decider with having that type of power, you know,
because
and he's not.
Thing.
And that's, you know, it's not natural how easy he is with that, how he rationalizes that.
For me, I actually took this kind of a more abstract metaphor about just like the current cancel culture we live in that, you know, anyone that you're outraged or pissed off with, you're going to just totally delete and just wipe away. And seeing how, you know, as I mentioned before, like so much of this show is entrenched in like the cool comic culture that's out there right now. I mean, and that's definitely a big, you know, prevalent theme, especially in like the last couple of years, in which anyone who makes even the slightest remarks, their whole careers are derailed. Mm-hmm. And that's what it's become. It's become cancel culture. We just immediately mute. We immediately block. I mean, this is something that like, you know, Black Mirror is definitely addressed. And for me, I felt Samir's power parallels that sort of idea and that sort of message. But I also thought it was definitely omissive on just the intimacy we demand from our entertainers, and that so much of entertainment today is just, I want to see, you know, what they're doing on a daily basis. I want to know who they're talking to. Who are they dating? You know, how, like, what do they eat? What's their sexual orientation? Like, what is their background? Where do they go to school? How many things did they do wrong? I think that the fact that you put that out there, there are consequences for that. Mm-hmm. You know, they're the people that you love. It's almost like, you know, it's not to draw back into Spider-Man here, but, you know, you put yourself out there on the line, especially if you're in a public domain, like, there are consequences for those that are around you and your loved ones. And I think that's what this episode sort of harkens upon. So
Matt mentioned Marvelous Ms. Maisel, and it's the exact same, you know, the crux of that story is that she exposes her family, and then you can't do comedy and also maintain your personal relationships. So I guess it's a real thing. Actually, another thing to your point, Mike, we have these ads, like I don't know if you've seen the ads with Jordan Peele and Chelsea Peretti, where they're a real life couple, but then there are ads that feature them where you're kind of seeing into their cutesy home life. And it's really weird to me. Like, I'm good for them getting the money, great. But it's weird to me because I feel like, okay, you're now, you know, staging your relationship for our entertainment while you sell stuff. You know, it's weird. But the fact that they're a real life couple is what makes it something that can be used as a tool to sell us stuff.
Well, I definitely think this episode had a commentary on what we as people are willing to do to become the next big thing, or, you know, to obtain followers on these meaningless social media sites. I mean, like, God, we were just watching the Firefest documentary, and like under people's names for their occupation was social media influencer. And that's the world we live in now, is that you can make a living off of promoting things because you have like 100,000 followers on a website. And I think that, like, when it comes down to his whole purpose is to get his name out there. And I think that's a really scary thought, is that it's everyone. Like, I even do it sometimes. We are all wanting that because it makes us feel, it's like when the likes come in on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter and you feel validated, or like, oh, someone agrees with me, or someone thinks that I'm funny. You know, it's scary to think that we as people rely on other people's opinions so much.
Yeah. What a world we live in.
Especially when it's so easy to misinterpret you. You know, so you don't want people to get the wrong idea, but you do want them to pay attention. You just want them to pay attention to exactly the narrative you're putting forward, which you can't control.
And then it kind of creates this like false cognitive dissonance of like, what is reality and what's this uncanny valley that you've created for yourselves? And then it's kind of a terrifying construct too, because then we're all just wandering around like we're fucking Sam Neill and in the mouth of madness being like, what is this is not reality. This is not reality. So I don't know. I just love the current, you know, world we live in. But Matt, what were your thoughts?
I mean, I shared all those same, I think, takeaways in terms of ideas of, you know, the validation and success we seek, and the lengths we'll go, what we'll put out there. You and I, Mike, I mean, we talk about it probably once a month writing a piece, maybe, like, quite how much should we reveal of ourselves, you know, to our readers. It's, you know, Consequence of Sound. So I totally get that. I totally get sort of this erasing culture. And I mean, that's kind of how I looked at it. Again, I think what's interesting about this type of story, this be careful what you wish for story, is you tend to see the real person, their true colors come out, or part of, or something they didn't know was there that came out. And I thought it was fascinating where Samir took that, where this story took that, but I was really uncomfortable with where it took it for a while. But then at the same time, he ultimately does the right thing in the end. And I mean, if there's one thing in 2019, I just look around and I admire, is someone who is willing to do the right thing. You know, who's not a moral coward, meaning they know it's the right thing and they're willing to do it. They don't shirk that responsibility, even if it means ending up in a wall, right? Even if it means not getting exactly what you want or at all what you want. You know, I don't think this is necessarily a happy ending for Samir, but I sure think it's a more noble ending than where he was heading otherwise. And he fixes, and everything around him is correct. So it works out for the other people around him, even though it doesn't necessarily for him. So
I guess that leads to one question then. Who won?
Who won?
Yeah, if you're, I mean, because I agree with you. I think it does have that sort of landing. If you would say, if you're saying that, who do you think wins here?
If your goal is to get everything you want to the world, you know, then it's not Samir, you know. If your goal is, I mean, to eventually do the right thing, and I you know, again, I believe in second chances. We live in a society right now that has given up the idea of second chances. And I don't want to live in that one because I don't know what chance I'm on at this point.
Same. I'm like a cat. Right? I'm on my ninth chance.
Yeah, so I think, you know what? I think Samir wins because, again, sometimes doing the right thing, and this is why people don't do it. It's difficult to, and a lot of times, you know, think about our society. We victimize the whistleblowers, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not victimized. We vilify the whistleblowers. I mean, we, you know, the people do the right thing. We say, oh, we're glad you do that. Then we fire them. We kick them out. We, you know, we ostracize them. So I think Samir wins. I think at the, I can't be comfortable with some of the steps he takes on his journey, but at the end of the day, he did the right thing. All the people he discarded are brought back and okay. I think he's a winner at the end of the day. I think he embraced the best part of himself at the end.
I would say Tracy Morgan is the winner. Tracy Morgan's character got exactly what he wanted. Was to
Is that what he wanted?
Yeah, sure? I think so. I think like that's the whole point of his power was to kind of create chaos for this character. And I think he, what he set out to do when he sat down at the bar and ordered his drink was to make this happen. And he does it again at the end of the story with his competition. So I think his whole purpose is to keep doing this to different comedians.
Always be curious. Always be curious to what end. And we'll never know the answer to that. What exactly happened to him and why he's doing what. I mean,
we'll never know.
Again, it's a lot of speculation. But no, I agree with you. He's clearly out. And when we see the Grinch smile at the end, he's clearly out too. To be devious and create mischief. So he does that, I guarantee you. And then he comes out and he yells. He yells at him, like, finish this off. Like, he has something to gain by him taking this next step.
Yeah.
Or it's like he's gaining souls or something. Like, if it was, yeah. You know, he's the new type of artist that uses actual people and portraits on walls and, you know,
yeah, he's
or
Freddy.
Something like that, you know.
It's like Freddy Krueger.
Always arts from real people. I don't know.
I think he does not win. I think Samir wins, but I think that JC Wheeler does not win. Because I think JC Wheeler is still, you know, he's still on the hunt. He's still out there. His story is not done. And I think that Samir, you know, goes as far as he can go. He wins the Twilight Zone, but he's also stuck in it. He doesn't escape it.
Yeah. There's no spoils to be had, yeah. But he, yeah, I agree with you. He wins.
He does the best he can.
I'm in between. I think it's one of those things where you're one of the best things about the Twilight Zone. You can kind of look at it in either way and kind of go from there. But I guess the last question we have to ask ourselves is in this next section we call Penny for Your Thoughts.
It doesn't matter, Mr. Poole. A man with your ability.
Hearing people's thoughts, strange delusion. But with proper medical care, it will go away.
Miss Turner, it is not a delusion. There, you see, I can read your thoughts.
In this section, we like to ask, what would you do here? Would you follow the same path as Samir, or would you keep going?
I would massacre every motherfucker in my way to get laughs.
I literally put the same thing. I put, like, destroy all those.
Whoa, fuckers. dude. I didn't actually mean that. I was telling it. I was just putting it out there to see which one of you are the, which one of you guys are the,
I guess it's are the me. Sick, oh, look at
this. You are the sick fuck in the room.
I am. They don't call you me that for nothing.
JC Wheeler.
I'm just saying.
In the fleshy flesh.
Especially the scene where he's going through his Facebook and he's like, oh, yeah, this fucker who, like, got away with rape or got away with drunk driving. It's like, we know growing up and becoming an adult means seeing all those people that you grow up with make bad decisions or horrible decisions in some of the cases. And the whole time I was just like, yeah, I'd do that. I'd probably do that. See, I don't know what that says about me as a person.
Well, I know exactly what it is. We don't have to get into that because right now I'm staying on your couch and I don't want kicked out for the night. But I'll say this. I say, like, I wouldn't do anything Samir did, but I'm also, I mean, the point is, I've never been put in that situation. I mean, I don't necessarily want to be a comedian, but, like, I write fiction and I've published fiction. And if someone comes to me and says, hey, you know, use this magic pen, you know, and you're going to write the great American novel and become famous, you know, and be the next Tom Wolfe and wear a white suit on late night. Do I say yes to that? I mean, I like to think I'd do the right thing, and I believe I would, but Samir thought he would do the right thing, too, when he's crying over Devin, and then we see where he goes next. So, I wouldn't kill people. I take all it back. I'm a good guy.
Once I realized I had killed my nephew, or taken him out of out of existence, I would go home, talk to my girlfriend for 100 hours telling her how, you know, this horrible thing happened until she thinks I'm crazy. I have a mental breakdown. And then we see me on a plane a few weeks later thinking there's something on the wing.
So you'd still get stuck in the Twilight Zone.
Definitely. But yeah, but I least, wouldn't kill people.
At least this side of the fifth dimension, I like that we're taking a stand for not just wiping out people and instead like dealing with our shit, wherever it leads us to.
Yeah.
I think that's healthy.
I think I'm more of the camp of Sammy. I'd probably do the same thing. There's just been too many shitty people in the world and that I've encountered that if I had this power, I would make sure I was very delicate about it and use it sparingly. You don't have to go on a comedy set every night. Just, you know, go every once in a while. That's all you need to do. So
you think you could use it sparingly?
I think you could.
But Mike, we're all shitty though.
Yeah.
Where do you draw the line? Because
that's the human exactly. condition, is we all make bad choices matter what.
I would just do the Dexter thing.
No, the human condition is we're all imperfect, so we don't let people like you decide things like that. Because we could all come under the axe.
It would be my dark passenger, and I would just be like, I need to go back up on the stage.
Deb.
What should I have done? Dad used to tell me that I shouldn't have gone up on
God,
the stage.
No, we don't need to go fucking that.
I love Dexter.
While we're here, let's retcon the first episode and talk about that great movie starring Robert De Niro.
Oh yeah,
and Wesley Snipes, The Fan.
Well, we don't need to go down that road. But the one thing we do need to do is give our overall thoughts.
Now we have done all we could do. If we've been successful, well and good. There are no problems. But if, on the other hand, this final treatment has not achieved the desired result, please remember, Miss Tyler, that you can still live a long and fruitful life among people of your own kind. All right, Miss Tyler. Here comes the last of it.
All right, we're going to doors it. How many doors? How many doors? We're going to start with you, Sammy.
I liked this episode, but I didn't like it as much as I liked Nightmare at 30,000 Feet. And I gave that 3 doors. So I feel like I have to give this one like a 2.5 door. And like that sucks because it seems so low for how much I actually enjoyed it. But I can't give it a 4. And I can't give it higher than the last episode. So I'm going to stick with 2.5 because I wasn't as enthralled in the story as I was with the other episode, the first episode. But I still really enjoyed it. And I found the acting to be superb. I thought the filming of it was beautiful. I loved that it was almost predominantly at night. Mm-hmm. I loved like the look of the comedy club. I think it was different. It was a new story. So that was nice to see. So I still really enjoyed it, but I'm still sticking with 2.5 doors.
Eleanor.
I'm going to go with 3 doors and a cat flap.
Oh, I like that. Why?
Actually, for all the same reasons that Sammy just said, but in reverse. Like, I liked this one better. But, you know, I'm hoping to be even more wowed, but I did think it was really good. I thought that it was fun to watch. There were a couple moments where I thought that Samir was you, Mike. So, yeah. So it was very familiar. And that amused me. So, thanks.
Oh, how about that? Matt.
Stuck between 3 doors and 2 doors with 1 ajar. If I have to pick, I'd say 3 doors. I thought the casting, the performances were great. I appreciate that it's a timeless sort of story. But again, they found a new way, and I hope this is what Jordan Peele continues to do, sort of finds little twists on it and explores it in a different way. I mean, I thought going into this, I was going to tell you all the plot points, all the twists, because I've seen it a million times. Again, we talked about all the illusions, literary and otherwise. But no, it examines some different things, which I appreciate. Again, what can you add? You know, what can you, while you're standing on the shoulders of giants, what can you add to these old stories? What makes us keep coming back for them? And I think we see some of that here. And I will say this, after the first 2 episodes, I mean, and I'm not the aesthetic person here, usually the visual one, but I think it's absolutely gorgeous the way it's been shot, with the camera angles, with the lighting. And I really can't wait till they start doing some really creative stuff like we saw in the original with it. I have a feeling there's going to be an episode pretty soon where we see that all sort of on full display, and it's going to be remarkable. So what did I say? 3?
You said 3.
3 doors, and I'm very enthusiastic start to this season.
Well, I'm going to take that enthusiasm because I'm going 4.
Whoa.
This is the first episode I saw because we watched, for some reason this was, you know, number one on the screeners, but I was blown away by this episode. This really made me realize just how how much potential this series has. And one of the things that I really championed in my review is the diversity. I mean, granted, for all the triumphs that Serling had in that area, that he could have in that area in the 50s and 60s, this show is just such a leap forward into showing like the true America. You know, I mean, just like there's just so much diversity in this episode. And it made me realize that there are so many different stories and perspectives that we're going to actually have in this series going forward, which makes me realize that, no pun intended, there's going to be a many doors to unlock going forward down here. And so in that respect, it felt like this new, hip, modern spin on one of my favorite shows of all time. And also just writing wise, I thought thematically this was really sound. I thought this was really rich. I thought the characters and the nuances that they gave to their actions were really there. I thought they used the runtime in just a perfect measure. I loved Kumail Nanjiani's performance. I thought that his tragedy was felt in ways that a lot of leads, even in some of the more iconic episodes, couldn't be felt because you don't spend that much time with them. So for me, it was really impacting. I thought Amara Karan was phenomenal again, once as usual. And, you know, like Sammy mentioned, she was great in The Night Of. To see her here and just that one performance, like you had mentioned, Matt, like when they're in the diner, it's just so good. And there's such a gripping reality of like the consequences that happen within the Twilight Zone. And just also that first time you see Jordan Peele just sitting there and it pans over into the dining room and he's just sitting there, it's just fucking great. And like this, which is why I'm kind of confounded, like that they didn't actually go with this as the first episode, but I understand why. Either way, four doors from me.
So that brings us to 3.19 doors.
I think so. Yeah, 3.19. Not too bad. Well, I think that's it. I think that brings us to the end of this episode. Next week, we'll be back with a third episode, Rewind, in which a woman believes she's experiencing the same moments over and over again. Ah, that sounds spooky, and it sounds like something that would be in the Twilight Zone. For now, please, please, if you haven't already, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. And also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, search for The Fifth Dimension. Not the, just Fifth Dimension. And you'll get some fresh content from us, and maybe we'll even do some sort of Instagram Live, something, you know, something cool and trippy. Who knows? Until next time, keep your eyes on the stars and your feet on the ground. And we'll be waiting here in the fifth dimension.
Consequence Podcast Network.